This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming, to movies, TV shows and pop culture, to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you from Chicago, USA, with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here, live from the NVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. Orly LaBelle, author and professor of law at the University of San Diego, joins me to speak about her book, You Don't Own Me, that breaks down the Barbie versus Bratz court battle. Thanks for joining me, Orly.
Thank you for having me.
I'm a little curious, why did you choose this case to write a book about? This is the Mattel versus MGA.
This story felt like it just had to be told. I went behind the scenes to understand this cultural icon, Barbie, that's been with us for 5 decades at least, that has really shaped our images of womanhood and images of kids and toys, and we don't know about her secret, very colorful history.
Could you give us an example of what her history is?
Yeah, so there's some dark side that people really don't know about, and Mattel doesn't necessarily want consumers to know about. First of all, Barbie wasn't really an original creation of Mattel, but rather she came from a German doll that wasn't a kid's doll, but it was really a sex toy. It was marketed for adults having affairs, giving it to their mistresses. That was Germany post-war, and this was a doll that was called Lily, and Mattel just kind of took her image from Europe and brought her to California and started producing, and Barbie became an overnight smash hit. What really drew me to the case, though, is that history repeats, because since then, Mattel is very set on this idea that it owns the image of Barbie and it owns the idea of Barbie, and it can control our culture and not allow artists to remix either the name Barbie or anything that has to do with her. So the book really follows all these fascinating litigation trials that happen when somebody, either a competitor or an artist, wants to challenge that.
I've read your book, and one of the things I didn't know was that the first time around, Mattel actually won. Why didn't that stand? Like, why was there given an opportunity for a second case?
Yeah, and you asked me about the motivation of writing this book. So another motivation is that this is just fascinating to see a trial that goes on twice with the same facts, the same sides, the same plaintiff and defendant, but yet it really changes completely with two different sets of attorneys, two very different lawyers that are the lead lawyers, and two very different judges, and also a different set of juries. So what happens is that the court decides in the first case to give everything to Mattel, and I don't want to create any spoilers, but with their claim that they own their competitor, they really win everything that they're claiming in the first trial. It goes up to an appeal to a very controversial judge, Judge Kaczynski, who I describe also in the book. He's one of the very colorful characters, and kind of I go into his personality. He's no longer on the bench because of the controversy surrounding his judiciary. But he comes out with a very different guidance on who owns culture, what can you do as a competitor, and then the second trial starts with that different mindset, and the personalities really come through with the executives. I interviewed executives on both sides, with Mattel and MGA, their competitor, and really you can see kind of the shift in how we understand who owns ideas, what is a competitive market, how do you use consumer psychology to sell products, and whether that's ethical.
Now, there's one person that I felt really bad for throughout this whole ordeal was Carter, who was the actual creator of Bratz. It really seemed like he was caught in between two, like, just giants, these titans, and he was being ripped apart and kind of left there. Did you get a chance to talk to him? Because I tried looking up stuff about him on the internet. He seems to be, like, not even have a fingerprint on there.
Yes. So absolutely, the story of Carter's personal tragedy from these two giants fighting it out on his ideas, on his back really, is very much the trigger and the beginning of the story. So it starts with a very creative designer, Carter Bryant, who has an idea for a different kind of doll, not Barbie, who's been really dominating the toy market and has this unrealistic, very white, very perfect idea of what a woman looks like. And he wants to create something that's more of the time, bratty, sassy, empowered girls that are multi-ethnic. He sells his idea to a competitor, and then, you know, all hell breaks loose. There's a decade-long litigation between these two companies. And exactly as you say, Carter is like a pawn in all of this court barrel. So you see him really disappearing, losing his voice. I describe it sort of as a Greek tragedy that in order for this new product to thrive and for the sassy entrepreneur, actually, who founds this biggest privately held toy company that competes with Mattel, in order for this company to thrive and the product to thrive, the father, the real father, is killed off. And you see also along the way with the testimonies in the trial that Carter just loses his voice, loses his will, really, to be part of the creative industry, part of the entertainment and toy industries, and disappears, literally disappears, actually. And I've interviewed so many different people for the book, but I tried to reach Carter in many different ways, through family, through sort of former business partners, and he's just disappeared.
Oh, wow. I thought he died. I'm not going to lie, because there's not even a picture. I found one picture, and it's like, it's the same picture that's being used in multiple different collages. And it's insane that how he just really fell off. And he wasn't at fault for this. He was trying to create. He felt kind of stifled at Barbie. And that's actually resonates, I think, with a lot of people who work with companies, that there isn't a chance to really be creative. You come 9 to 5, you do your job, and then you go home. And I think this book really shows how corporations kind of stifle your creativity. Or did I take that kind of wrong?
No, you understood it completely correctly. And really, this story is both specific and fascinating in everything that happened there, with very dark details and personalities. But it's also a universal story that happens in every industry, in every kind of job position. People are regularly taking jobs where they have these big dreams about being creative and fulfilling their potential. They sign these very draconian agreements that say that anything that they end up inventing, innovating, creating, designing, improving upon, these are very, very broad legalistic language that, you know, most people don't really understand or read. And they sign these standard contracts. And this later on means that even when the company, like Carter experienced at Mattel, is stifling their creativity, not really using any of their creative ideas, rejecting them, they can't then leave and be free to compete, be free to use their creativity in the market.
Now, what's a little bit scary, I didn't think of contracts until, you know, I started reading this book, and I thought of a contract I signed when I was 17 years old, and I worked for just, you know, a local food chain around my house. And I remember signing it and reading it, that I'm a representative of the company and everything I do is a part of the company, blah, blah, blah. I was signing myself away, in essence, to the food industry. Let's say I was 18 and I made some kind of new conveyor belt, you know, on my free time. Would that have meant this grocery store food chain had rights to it then?
That's an excellent question, and no attorney can answer it just kind of in the abstract of not knowing where you were working. So there's a great variation between the different states. Actually, California has a bit more freedom and a bit more protection for employees than other states. It depends on what the language is of the contract and what courts will enforce. At the same time, even though as a legal scholar I can't answer, you know, how every court will interpret every contract, the reality is that you, at the age of 18, won't take that risk of fighting it out in the courtroom. So this is actually what happens in You Don't Own Me, in the story of Mattel versus MGA, that Mattel sues really any competitor, any artist that challenges, you know, their contractual understanding of these very generic contracts that they ask everybody to sign, or infringe upon what they claim as their intellectual property, their copyright, their patents. So their practices to launch litigation, oftentimes they'll lose, but the reality is that most people, if they get a letter from a company later on, like you're 18 and this former employer says you have to stop doing what you do because we own your ideas, we own your invention, most likely that you'll just, you know, be like Carter Bryant, you'll just kind of disappear and not have the staying power of hiring an attorney and spending millions and millions in defending your case, even if you are, you know, just and right in your claims, in your defense.
I know a lot of people who kind of, they work in the media industry, radio, television, and they usually have some kind of side business, you know, the marketing, or they're doing some kind of agent work. Would that be bad? I mean, if you decide to become an entrepreneur and you're still working, should you still work in the same industry that you have an independent business in? Or should you work in two different industries? That way it doesn't have any conflicting interests. Like if I wanted to be an entrepreneur with, I don't know, marketing, I should work at Walmart. That way there's no conflicting interest.
The very question that you're asking means that there's some loss when people choose not to use their skills and the experience that they're most comfortable in and you know their talent really because they're trying to minimize the risk that they're breaking some kind of contract or infringing some duty of loyalty that they have for their employer. I think that it's important for people who are entering the job market right now. And as you say, you know, these days we don't have any more this idea, like I see my students, that you'll start in one position and you'll end up with that position at the end of, you know, 40 years of a career and you'll get the gold watch and retire. That's not the job market reality anymore. That's not what employers promise, no job security, and it's not what employees expect from their career trajectory. So people have to manage their own careers, and they have to be pretty assertive and concerned about the kinds of contracts that they're signing. It's a good idea to not just sign blindly, definitely not after you've accepted a job offer, because this is something that I've researched a lot, and really the majority of employees, they accept a job offer and then they get a really long contract, and it's sort of like consumers, you know, we just click wrap, you know, not really understanding or reading all the waivers that we sign. So it's good to have an open conversation. It's good to know what kind of employer you're working for, if they're going to be very litigious against their employees or former employees. So companies have reputations, and some companies have wonderful reputations of actually encouraging these side businesses of employees, because I've argued and I've shown in my research that it can actually really enrich the kind of work that you're doing. So let's say you're a radio show host and you also have a blog. That's awesome. You know, it's kind of cross fertilizing, and so. I think smart employers will be encouraging of that.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the employee handbooks that come as soon as you agree to a job. Let's say you read the handbook and you're like, oh, I really don't like this one part in the contract. Can we talk about this, you know, Mr. New Boss? And most of the time they'll sit there and say, well, no, we can't. You either sign it or you just don't want the job. How do you negotiate with people that when you know that they're not going to negotiate on these contracts? Do you just walk away?
You're right that a lot of times, even if you're aware that the contracts or the handbooks are really one-sided and they can present a lot of issues, a lot of companies won't be open to negotiating. A lot of it depends on whether you have bargaining power, whether you have outside offers that are better. So I think, you know, one of the things that I'm particularly concerned about is that women don't do as good a job in negotiating all of these issues as men, and it's part of the pay inequity and kind of the... I actually think that some of these contracts are... It's the other side of the Me Too movement that's happening. So, you know, with Me Too, there's been a lot of concern about how women are silencing their own voices because they're signing a lot of these NDAs and settling harassment suits with a promise that they'll never talk about it, and then other employees don't know about what's going on in the workplace. These contracts are actually the same kind of contracts. You know, when you're signing these agreements that you won't disparage your company, you won't speak to other people about their terms and conditions, about their salaries. A lot of these laws or contracts are illegal under various state laws because we actually have a right to share, to speak, to speak out against the employer when you see something that's draconian and you don't think should be enforced, and you have the right to say it and not be retaliated against. But I think that women have a tendency to not assert those rights. So it's hard to give kind of this abstract ideas of or advice without having the concrete context of who the employer is. And that's why I think it's quite astounding that people, you know, go to regular checkups with doctors, and they understand that when they're getting a divorce, they need a lawyer. And, you know, there's all kinds of professionals that you need. But when people actually start work, they usually don't get a lot of advice. And I think that's the time when you actually need to read, you need to try to bring things up, and you need somebody to support you from the outside, whether it's counsel or other employees that have gone through similar experiences.
Now, going back to the lawsuit of Mattel versus MGA, one of the things that I thought was kind of sketchy on MGA's part is that the CEO, Larian, he kept telling everybody, I'm the one who created Bratz. You know, my daughter was the inspiration. It was my son who wanted to do this. They really tried to play down Carter's role. And, you know, to me, that screamed, oh, you know, they knew what they were doing was wrong. But besides that, Larian was taking credit for something he knew wasn't his. Is that something that's common that CEOs do?
I absolutely think it's common. So if you think about Steve Jobs, you know, inventing the iPhone and the iPad and the Mac and, you know, all the Apple products, we have a culture of kind of heroic romanticizing of the CEO and not really seeing the people in the trenches that are doing the creative work. And there's, you know, huge gaps in not only the credit that people get for these products that are really, you know, starting from below and their team efforts, but of course, you know, the rewards as well. It's not just the credit in terms of reputation, but huge gaps in the salaries. I think, you know, part of it is a lot of marketing that goes into the brand. And so with Larian, it wasn't only that he knew that Mattel is very litigious and that if they find out that a former employee gave them the idea, gave MGA the idea of a new doll line, they will be litigious, as they were once they found out. This is another fascinating part of the story where I describe this anonymous letter that comes later to Mattel after Bratz has already been developed. And with this anonymous letter, they find out that Carter Bryant was behind the original designs. So that's, you know, certainly one reason that Larian appropriates the message and kind of the credit for the invention. But it's also really kind of this culture of I had the, you know, kids and I had an idea of something completely different, and I'm the face of the company, and he's actually a really sassy, colorful character who, in some, you know, ironic way, is emulating the dolls that he produces, the Bratz dolls. So he likes to pose with them and kind of speak to the media about how he really understands toys. He, during the 10-year trial, he tells the media and journalists all kinds of kind of funny things about the other side. So he says the CEO of Mattel, this is Bob Eckert, he's this very corporate, traditional CEO. He knows nothing about toys. He comes from cheese, he likes to say, because he was formerly the CEO of Kraft. And Larian likes to create that image, and I think there's a lot to the image that he really lives and breathes toys, and that's what he does.
I remember that part with the letter. I was thinking to myself, you know, this is a toys, and so much espionage is here, secret agents and such. Is that always the case with this? Like, is this can be found in every corporation, or is this something that was uniquely amongst the toys?
Story of Mattel's intelligence department, the spies at the toy fairs, and the fraudulent ways that they posed as coming from somewhere else and infiltrating the different other presenters and taking away, you know, really engaging in illegal economic espionage. I think it's an extreme version of what goes on in a lot of markets and industries. So that, again, it's a fascinating story to see the extent to which Mattel was willing to go to compete in the courtroom, in the market, in, you know, ethical and unethical ways. But I think that more and more we do have these arms that mostly we don't know about in corporations, and they're basically only uncovered when there are these very public disputes and wars between two companies. But economic espionage is a very real thing. You know, there's data that shows that after the Cold War, there were all these spies that were left without a job, basically. You know, there was less government jobs to do all kinds of those spying, infiltrating, you know, hacking jobs that they had expertise in, and a lot of them ended up being hired in the private market to do the same kind of thing in market competition.
Oh wow, that's pretty scary. I remember watching The Toys That Made Us. It's a show on Netflix, and they talked about Barbie, and one of them was how this lady was like, yeah, we heard on the grapevine from somebody that there's a toy coming out that was like a rock star thing. That's all we knew. And we had to sit there and make our own Barbie version. And we knew theirs was coming out in 6 months, so we had to do it in 3. And I was like, that's so exciting. But to hear that theirs is probably from the Cold War, that's pretty extreme.
They got in real trouble. I mean, that's you asked me about the different iterations and different outcomes in the two trials that happened, that, you know, the story that I tell in You Don't Own Me. And part of it was that in the first trial, it was really Mattel accusing MGA for taking something from them. And slowly, as we enter the second trial, there are all these counterclaims and new facts that are added to show that really they were doing, you know, 100 times more unethical things than they were accusing their competitors of doing.
As an employee, because I'm not at the height of the food chain as of right now, but I'm somewhere at the bottom. And my thing is I would like to protect myself from, you know, I guess the companies I work with and all these other places I would like to work with too. How do I do that? How do I set it up so that my ideas are my own? And the reason I say this is because technically I'm connected all day long, and so are a lot of other people. Your boss calls you in the middle of the night, they email you, they text you, it seems like you're working all the time technically. So how can you protect your own ideas now?
Yeah, that was part of the big dispute in You Don't Own Me in Mattel versus MGA, where Mattel developed this idea that even when you're sleeping, you, because of this contract that you signed, you really owe your dreams and your, you know, ideas that come up and kind of that eureka moment if you're in the shower at home during the weekend, you still owe that idea to Mattel as your employer. And that, you know, I've argued against that extreme interpretation of these innovation assignment contracts that are very standard in every industry. And eventually, MGA, which, you know, developed, the team of attorneys that represented MGA really developed this defense of weekends and nights, they called it. They said, you know, weekends and nights should be your own, and you shouldn't be all the time connected, as you say, and owing all your inspiration to your employer. But it's really hard. So one of the things is really to keep separate what you're doing for your employer and what you're doing on your own. So having two laptops is actually a really important part of it, just keeping your devices separate, your accounts separate, your notes separate, having notarized some, or, you know, notarized and maybe stamped or filed in various kind of formal avenues, some of your ideas to really show the timeline of when you created something is really important. So, you know, part of the fascinating story of You Don't Own Me is how do you prove inspiration? How do you prove that moment when a great idea comes to you? And that's really hard to do, and the company will always have these alternative stories that they'll tell the jury, like, sure, you were inspired because we told you, you know, to do this, or a coworker worked with you on these ideas, or we sent you to a workshop that ignited your, you know, creative juices. You need to really, as an employee, protect the alternative story of understanding, you know, how you developed something and why it's separate from the work that you've been doing for a company.
Now, this was a long time ago. A friend told me to protect myself, I should take an ad out in the newspaper saying that this is what I was planning on doing. That was like really old school kind of stuff, though. Would that still work nowadays? Like if I took an ad out saying, hey, you know, this is Mason and this is what I'm planning to do or doing business under, does that still work today? Or because of the internet, it probably wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think that you necessarily need to take an ad, and I don't think it would protect you if the facts are not in your favor. I think, again, trying to, if you have something that's copyrightable or patentable or could be a trademark, going to the appropriate office and getting the stamp of approval, the registration, would be more protective than taking an ad out.
Well, thank you, Orly, for joining me. I really appreciate it. For those listening, where can they find your book and more information about you?
So the book, You Don't Own Me, is available on Amazon and all the local booksellers, all the online booksellers. It's available in hard copy and in Kindle, and I would just love for everybody to read it and spread the word and review it. It's been really fun. There's some talks about movie rights because I think the reader will see that it's just really fascinating psychology of the people who are battling it out in the toy market and creating our culture.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Head to WGNradio.com for exclusive content by Mason. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter @MasonVeraPayne, that's all one word, and don't forget to share the show with your friends.